Intelligent Medicine is brought to you in part by Fullscript, my exclusive online supplement dispensary. Fullscript is the most trusted source for professional-grade supplements. It's safe, secure, and with Fullscript's refill reminders, it's totally effortless to stay on track with your supplement protocols. Go to drhoffman.com and click on the store to create your Fullscript patient account today. And if you're a healthcare provider, sign up for a free Fullscript dispensary account at fullscript.com/intelligentmedicine. It's the easiest way for you to prescribe the exact supplement protocols your patients need. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, a very important one, if I might say so, because it's all about cholesterol and cholesterol phobia and fat phobia and our infatuation with statins as a means of combating heart disease. According to today's guest, he makes the controversial assertion that we've taken a wrong turn in our management of cardiovascular disease. He's Dr. David Diamond. He's has a PhD in the field of biology, and his specialty is in neuroscience. He's a professor at University of South Florida, but lately he's turned his attention to matters related to cardiovascular disease prevention. And in part one, we talk about his own personal background propelling him to do some open-minded investigation of some of what was thought to be settled science, meat kills, saturated fat kills. So, David, you mention a key figure in this drama, which is Ansel Keys. Who is Ansel Keys, and what does he have to do with this?
So what you have in the 1950s is this fellow named Ansel Keys, who really had little claim to fame until he basically came out with the announcement in his research that the reason why President Eisenhower, 1955, had a heart attack mm-hmm. was because he ate sausage and bacon and eggs for breakfast. Ansel Keys decided...
And of course, that was thought to be a teachable moment. You know, the President of the United States has a heart attack. This really propelled this into the consciousness of Americans, because prior to that, heart attacks weren't really so much on the map. For one reason or another, Americans suffered fewer heart attacks.
Right. So the rate of heart attacks was relatively low, but it was increasing. And so it was a concern. And frankly, when you look back at the history and what was going on in the 50s, no one was really explaining why it was more Americans were having heart attacks. Of course, now we know there were really two major factors, that people were smoking a lot more, but no one was talking about smoking actually causing heart disease in the 1950s. And probably the margarine that people were consuming then was extremely high in trans fats, which then actually contributes to heart disease. That's the irony, is people thought they were eating healthy, and the margarine was actually killing.
That was like a World War II innovation, because you know, the expression guns and butter, they would ship the good stuff to the troops in the field to keep them fighting, and the folks stateside had to settle for that cheap synthetic crap, the trans fat margarines.
Exactly. So what you had is people were consuming margarine and they're smoking more, and the two were really the critical factors. But Keyes did not believe actually that it was smoking or margarine. What he said was it's animal fat. And he didn't state it in a form of hypothesis. He stated it as fact. And because he believed in it so strongly. And I think what's important is right around that time, people were looking at the disease, familial hypercholesterolemia, and they're seeing that a subset of people who are dying of heart attacks relatively young, they had sky-high cholesterol. So they put the two together, and you also find cholesterol in the atheroma. So you got cholesterol in the coronary arteries. You got people with high blood cholesterol. You got people consuming cholesterol and saturated fat. You simply put it all together, and logically, they must be linked. That's where this diet-heart hypothesis mm-hmm. came from, and Ansel Keys was a primary promoter for this. And then the irony is, now what you find is, and this is real science, if you consume corn oil, you dramatically lower your cholesterol, your total mm-hmm. cholesterol.
Yeah, I had a professor in medical school who actually told us that we should all be taking a quarter cup of corn oil every day to prevent cardiovascular disease.
Well,
he did it.
Exactly.
Yeah, I tried to check and see if he was still alive. I didn't find any listing for him though.
Well, there was a clinical trial that followed that, and it's in a British Medical Journal, 1964-65, and they did exactly that. They had people, and it was a pure study. It was really well done. They had actually secondary prevention, people already diagnosed with heart disease. One group would explicitly have a couple tablespoons of corn oil a day. They lowered their cholesterol, and the other group was told to go home and eat what you want.
Mm-hmm. So it worked. They lowered their cholesterol. Hooray.
It did lower their cholesterol, dramatically lowered the cholesterol, and the group with lower cholesterol had more deaths and more heart disease, more heart attacks.
Okay.
It's remarkable to me that everyone is ignoring this paper, and there's methodologically nothing wrong with it whatsoever. So that's where we actually begin. We can end up with statins, but we really need to understand the corn oil industry pays the American Heart Association a lot of money to promote corn oil. They still recommend corn oil over butter. Mm-hmm. They recommend margarine over butter, and clearly this is related to sponsorship. And you will actually hear about the heart healthy benefits of corn oil because it lowers cholesterol, not because you're actually less likely to have a heart attack. So and in fact, whenever you hear about reduced risk, you're really talking about cholesterol. You're not talking about less heart attacks. So that's where it all begins, with hypercholesterolemia associated with heart disease. Cholesterol is in the plaque. And Ancel Keys says, you see, we put this all together, and we've got heart attacks.
Well, let's now focus on LDL for a moment, though, because LDL is really the villain here in this story. It's actually, the guidelines now state that, it's kind of how low can you go? Cholesterol limbo. You know, for someone who's an ordinary person, definitely get the LDL below 130. If you have risk factors, and they can always find risk factors, you're male, or you're a couple pounds overweight, or you have a family history, bingo, it should be under 100. If you've had cardiovascular disease, they want it vanishingly low. They want it below 70. You have done a really, really interesting investigation of LDL cholesterol and its relationship to cardiovascular disease and mortality. And what did you come up with when you investigated?
Well, again, I try to understand history, try to understand why people believe what they do in science. And so this can be traced to Brown and Goldstein winning the Nobel Prize in 1985. And they declared as fact that LDL causes heart disease. And they were very well supported by Big Pharma, by the way. And so they said LDL needs to be the target. So it has an ancient history. And so drugs were developed in the 1980s to lower LDL. Cholestyramine actually lowers cholesterol quite nicely. And so you had your first trial in 1984 in which they actually tested lowering LDL, actually having some benefit, and it had absolutely no benefit whatsoever.
It's the most constipating drug in the world. That's a horrible side effect.
It is an awful drug, isn't it?
Anybody who's taken it will tell you they'd rather die of a heart attack than take that medication.
That is, obviously you can't really do a placebo, but they try. They had a placebo group, and these are people with hypercholesterolemia, given cholestyramine for 7.5 years, and ultimately trivial differences between the treated and untreated groups. And this study was actually seen, this is the first time in which you have statistical manipulation of the data, in which there was no statistically significant effect. Actually, it was about 0.4% between treated and untreated people as far as coronary events. And they artificially inflated it to call it a 24% reduction in coronary events by lowering LDL. This is the Lipid Research Clinic study, 1984 in JAMA. Mm-hmm. So it's the first time in which the, in a sense, the advocates for lowering cholesterol clearly manipulated the data.
You actually co-wrote a paper, which has a wonderful title, How Statistical Deception Created the Appearance That Statins Are Safe and Effective in Primary and Secondary Prevention of Cardiovascular Disease. You wrote that with Uwe Ravenskopf, who's a outspoken critic of statin drugs.
Right. So, I was quite surprised we got away with that title.
Yeah.
We had three tough reviewers and I want to emphasize to your listeners, this is an expert review of clinical pharmacology. It is a well-respected peer-reviewed journal, but the facts were indisputable, and that's why we were able to have that title.
Well, give our listeners a basic primer in relative versus absolute risk. Can you explain it in a succinct way?
Sure. So when you have an ad, and this is specifically, for example, in the Lipitor ad, which is out in 2002, it's very famous. The ad says that Lipitor reduces heart risk, coronary events, by 36%, which is a huge number.
Yeah.
I mean, you almost feel immune having heart disease.
I'm all for it.
And this actually helped to promote Lipitor to generate over $100 billion in revenue. And that's great. And that's the relative risk. Now, And you really need to ask, well, whenever you see percent, sometimes, you know, you got to question, what does it mean? So I went to the original paper and looked at the raw data. And I said, well, what is the actual rate of coronary events in the placebo group and the Lipitor group? And I found it remarkable. So the incidence of heart disease, not death, there was no difference in death, but the incidence in coronary events was 1% between placebo and the treated group, well, which so actually means
another
that...
Another way of saying it, it's like 98% of the people who took the statin were alive, or I mean didn't have heart attacks, and 97% who didn't
exactly.
have heart attacks. So that's 1%
difference.
Minuscule.
97% versus 98%.
Right.
The difference being 1%.
Which is one third.
And
there you have it.
Which is one third. And if you just, I like to tell people, so you've got a really incompetent financial advisor, and the best he can do is come up with a 1% rate of return, which you're very unhappy about. But, you know, last year he only had 0.5%. So he says, listen, I doubled your return this year.
Hey, that's a great
okay?
analogy.
That is relative improvement. That's using numbers to manipulate the data.
Mm-hmm.
1% is twice as much as 0.5%. But the bottom line is you're still only making 1%. So if a patient says, what is the likelihood that I will not have a heart attack if I don't take the Lipitor? The answer is 97%. You are 97% likely not to have a heart attack, and you're improving yourself only up to 98% by taking the Lipitor.
And this is also, we have to keep in mind that the vast majority of people who check into emergency rooms with heart attacks these days, because of the prevalence of statin prescribing, they're on statins. So, that you know, it's really misleading.
Well, what's happening is, and actually, again, you look at the historical records, even before the statins, there was little difference in cholesterol levels between those having the heart attacks and not having heart attacks. I mean, as it turns out, it's a very poor marker for heart disease, the LDL-C by itself. Just looking at cholesterol is a very poor marker. I mean, it's been driven to a great extent, this has all been driven by fear of hypercholesterolemia. The subset of individuals that have cholesterol of 3, 4, 500, you find some of them do have heart attacks young. But what I'm actually writing now, I'm reviewing the entire literature on familial hypercholesterolemia, this again with Uffe Ravenscoff, and what we're finding is repeated observations that people that have 2-3 times as much LDL, LDL in the 200 to 300 level, mm-hmm. have a normal lifespan.
You know,
and that may people find that remarkable.
So one observation I've made in working with a lot of patients on low-carb diets, you know, we switch them, they lose weight, they feel better.
Their LDL goes up.
Their LDL goes
right.
up. So it's a little paradoxical, and that creates some concern and alarm. But can we explain that paradox that people may be less at risk in spite of a higher LDL on a higher fat diet or higher cholesterol diet when they restrict carbs?
Well, first, you mentioned one of my papers, and another one in which I had the great pleasure to work with about a dozen MDs and PhDs, including cardiologists. And we reviewed the literature on LDL in people at highest risk of heart disease, that is older people, people over 60. And the remarkable thing is when you look at every single paper that had ever been published on older people and their LDL levels, what you find is either no relation of LDL levels, even sky-high LDL, to mortality, coronary or otherwise. And in fact, in a majority of the studies, you find people with the highest LDL live longer and are healthier mm-hmm. than those with low LDL.
And especially women. We see a cohort of women who have enormously high cholesterol. It could be over 300. They also have very high HDLs. They're the women
right.
who are likely to become nonagenarians and centenarians.
Yeah, so what we really need to think differently about this. This is where I've come. LDL is so important to our metabolism. You know, cardiology has dominated our thinking when it comes to heart disease and health, but LDL is a part of our immune system. It's actually LDL works with our white blood cells to target pathogens.
Hmm.
And in fact, as well as our own cells that run awry, people with extremely high cholesterol have very low rate of cancer. In fact, you find the people with low LDL have 10 times as much cancer as people who have LDL at 200, 300, well over 200. So the LDL is a crucial part of our metabolism. People are much more vulnerable to sepsis if they have low LDL mm-hmm. compared to high LDL. So this is really a health marker. And the fact that when you eat less sugar and your LDL rises, to me, that's nothing to be concerned about at all. That actually means that, you know, your liver is functioning optimally to be able to enhance your health. It's a good thing. My LDL rose as well. My LDL-C rose when I went low carb, and I have no concern about it whatsoever. I mean, I actually feel good about it, that I'm now in the right age, the right LDL levels to live a very long, healthy life.
Indeed.
Now, if I could add,
sure, please.
What we do need to be concerned about, because LDL is influenced by our hormones and our blood sugar. And when we hear about small, dense LDL being associated with heart disease, I actually believe that is real. Mm-hmm. So things happen when we have chronically high blood sugar. This is why people with diabetes just have so many other diseases there. The reason why people with diabetes are so susceptible to heart disease as well as cancer and other diseases is because the glucose is damaging proteins, including the proteins in our lipoproteins in the LDL as well as the HDL. So that's what the small dense LDL is. And when that is happening, you're talking about damaged LDL caused by the sugar. And that's why when we lower our sugar levels, we actually have larger, more fluffy LDL. We have less small, dense LDL. So the idea of targeting LDL as a drug with a drug is completely wrong. What we want to do is target the high blood sugar. And again, I'm right now not amenable to using the medication. The easiest way to lower blood sugar is simply to eat less sugar.
Indeed. Okay, folks, as we usually do, let's give one of our sponsors an opportunity to share this message with you. Here it goes. As an Intelligent Medicine listener, you know how important it is to ensure that your supplements are genuine, professional grade, and effective. But vetting your sources and tracking down the exact products you need can be a hassle. That's why I use FullScript as my online dispensary, so I can send you, my patients and listeners, the exact products you need straight to your door by speedy delivery. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere. The best part, FullScript sends out refill reminders when you're running low, so it's totally effortless to stay on track with your supplement protocols. Go to drhoffman.com and click on the store to create your FullScript account, or ask your healthcare provider to sign you up for FullScript. If you are a healthcare provider, sign up for a free FullScript account at fullscript.com/intelligentmedicine. FullScript is the most trusted source for professional-grade supplements. It's safe, secure, and HIPAA-compliant, and they offer world-class support. Get started at drhoffman.com and click on the store. Thanks for listening. And now back to our guest, Dr. David Diamond. And as a neuroscientist, you have a special perspective on cholesterol because it's well known that the brain is largely consists of cholesterol. There's an enormous amount of cholesterol in
right.
the brain.
Exactly. Not only is there about 25% of the cholesterol of the body is found in the brain produces its own cholesterol. And in fact, I published a paper along with my group at University of South Florida, in which we looked at FDA adverse events, cognitive adverse events. And we found that the highest rate of adverse events, clearly by far, were with the statins that actually are lipophilic, which means they can actually gain access to the brain through the blood-brain barrier, and one of which was Lipitor. So you find it's very common, for example, for Lipitor, people taking Lipitor have cognitive events, but not so much for Crestor, because Crestor doesn't get in the brain.
And less so for Pravacol. Now, Pravacol also, I think, is less...
Less likely because it's more hydrophilic. So if any molecule that's hydrophilic doesn't get in the brain. But I think the really important point is, This was in the media, and yet the FDA, which actually does report cognitive events with statins, you would think the FDA would want to specifically say, well, it's the lipophilic statins. And yet people don't know about this paper that we published, and it was actually very difficult to get it out. But that's what you raise a really important point. The brain uses cholesterol. It makes its own cholesterol to be able to make new brain cells. Neurogenesis depends on cholesterol. Synapses require new cholesterol. And so clearly that's why memory is impaired when people are taking statins.
There's also hormonal consequences because cholesterol is a building block for
for all the steroid hormones.
Yeah.
For for all the steroid hormones as well as for vitamin D, one needs cholesterol. Cholesterol is also used to make the adrenal hormones. So you're really talking about a critical molecule that's just essential for metabolism. So what is it that actually causes heart disease? What is so critical is increased blood sugar and stress. What they're doing is actually targeting platelets. In my latest lectures, I talk about blood coagulation. And so when the blood coagulates, it is blocking those coronary arteries. Specifically, it's in the coronary wall where you're seeing a blockage of blood flow. And that is originating with increased blood sugar, activation of platelets, blockage of the blood vessels within the coronary wall, which ultimately ends in blockage of the coronary arteries.
And that actually may be a key to the apparent partial efficacy, because there is some efficacy to statins, according to some studies. We're not saying that statins don't have an impact on cardiovascular disease, but there were what are called pleiotropic effects of certain drugs. In other words, a drug is intended to do one thing, but then it does another. In the case of statins, they act as super aspirins. They're anti-inflammatory, and potentially maybe they're a little bit of a blood thinner. Or is that
and you
possible?
Know, I think that's so important, because corn oil, cholestyramine, and this newer drug, the newer category called CETP inhibitors, which actually do everything right. This a new category around the last 20 years, increases HDL, lowers LDL, does everything right, and absolutely no benefit whatsoever. And only the statins have this 1% to 2% benefit, and I think you're absolutely right, because sort of the side effects, which essentially are the real effects, is that statins are also anti-inflammatories and anticoagulants. And so they have this kind of super aspirin type effect, which has some benefit. Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right. The reason why you see some benefit is it has nothing to do with the cholesterol lowering aspect of statins, and has to do with the pleiotropic effects.
So bottom line, for our listeners who are, you know, ready to jettison their statins, are there no circumstances where cholesterol lowering drugs might prove valuable?
Well, it's interesting, because I'm always debating with people. I work with cardiologists, and I've noticed that very prominent cardiologist that I have great respect for, one of which who is Asim Malhotra, who lectures on this all the time, but they still think that there's a benefit for secondary prevention.
Okay.
And I have asked them
for... Can you explain the distinction there?
Well, so primary prevention means you're taking a medication so that you don't develop a disease. So you would take the statin in advance of having any
symptoms. You've not had a heart attack. You don't have angina.
Right.
You
know, okay. No angina, no symptoms whatsoever, but you take the statin because you're hoping in the future you won't have a heart attack. So that's in advance of a disease. Mm-hmm. Secondary prevention means that you've already had some disease, you've already had a heart attack, you've had the angina, and so you're taking the statin now to forestall any further disease development. So what I find is the people I respect the most are consistently against primary prevention, that there's essentially no value whatsoever to statins for primary prevention. You're not going to really have any effect on reducing heart disease, and we haven't even gotten into all the adverse effects with the statins. So even a 1%, when I've lectured to physicians in grand rounds, the physician has said, granted, there's only a 1% benefit. But when you're talking about 100 million people taking statins, 1%, a lot of people, to which I would agree. If we had a drug that reduced any disease by 1% and had no adverse effects, I'd be all for it. But the adverse effects of statins have been very well described. But before I get on to the adverse effects, I still stand, and of course I give no medical advice.
Yeah.
I simply am evaluating the literature. I see no real substantial benefit for secondary prevention for people who already have heart disease. And in fact, in our paper on statin deception, we reviewed one of the most prominent secondary prevention studies, the British Heart Protection Study, which a large number of people already with heart disease or with diabetes had taken the statins. And it was like a 2% benefit. And yet there were also the side effects.
Another way to put it is with something called NNT, number needed to treat. So that's another way of portraying, you know, realistically to patients, the advantages or potential drawbacks of taking a medication. Can you translate that to primary and secondary prevention?
Yeah, the NNTs are extraordinarily large. Both primary and secondary prevention, the number needed to treat is typically around 100. And I don't see a lot of difference between primary and secondary. Now, what that means is you need to treat 100 people with a statin to have an effect, which is to block one heart attack in one person.
Over a period of years.
99 people will not.
Over perhaps 5 years.
And that's over years.
Yeah.
Well, this is actually manipulative of the industry. The mm-hmm. typical study lasts only about 2 years.
Okay.
And so what they will do is say, well, the NNT over 2 years is 100, and they accept that.
Okay.
But then they say, well, but if you then take that over 20 years, the NNT now drops until it's only about 1 in 20.
But that's an extrapolation. That isn't necessarily
the case. Exactly. It's extrapolation. Yeah. And what they won't do is extrapolate the number needed to harm the NNH.
Right. So let's get into that. What are some of the other drawbacks that can occur?
Well, the most common one, joint damage, the muscle damage, the myopathy is very well described. It's very common that people have muscle problems. And this has been extremely well characterized. And it may very well be 20 to 30% of statin users report mm-hmm. muscle problems.
Mm-hmm.
But what's even more serious?
And it's camouflage because they often say, hey, you know, guess what? You know, you're 58 or you're 64
exactly,
or you're 75. And what do you expect? What do you expect?
Great point. And that also goes along with the cognitive effects. They say, listen, you know, you're getting old, and so you've got memory problems. So sometimes it is subtle. And clearly, most of these studies are designed by the drug companies, and their interest really isn't to find side effects. So they're not studied as thoroughly. They're not giving people cognitive tests over the 6 months to a year in which they're doing the study. So that's not really in the design of the study, is to find these adverse effects. And frankly, one of the most profound effects found was by accident, that when you look at the Jupiter study, in which they were first testing Crestor, they were not looking for adverse effects. They were not looking for diabetes. But so many people were reporting that the new onset diabetes that they included that in the paper, a significant increase in diabetes. Now, when you actually do the test right, and you follow people over the course of about 5 years, and you get their blood glucose levels, or the fasting blood glucose and A1C, you find a doubling in the rate of new onset diabetes in people who take statins. And it's not a doubling from 1 to 2. It's a doubling from about 6 to 12% mm-hmm. of the people who take statins develop diabetes.
That's a more meaningful statistic. Really, yeah.
That is a meaningful doubling, because you're talking about 6% of people who were healthy before who now have developed statins. Now, besides that, this is another thing. They love to say, the people in big pharma will say, well, there's no cancer that develops from statins. And realize, the tobacco industry would have loved to have had 2-year trials on development of cancer as well. And it's really not scientifically appropriate to say there's no cancer from statins, because you have only a 2 to 3 year trial. But when you look at longitudinal studies, or you look at retrospective studies, you do find cancer, especially in vulnerable populations. In the PROSPER study, which is one of the only ones to look at elderly people, what you find is a significant increase in the incidence of cancer in older men. And you find a doubling, again, doubling in the rate of breast cancer when you look over 10 years with women using statins, and they're controlling for cholesterol levels as well in this work. So the cancer findings are out there. The cataracts, and erectile dysfunction has been published numerous times, and it makes sense. You're lowering men's testosterone, and you're producing in a substantial percentage of men, statistically significant, erectile dysfunction. And again, the doctor typically will attribute it to getting older.
Yeah.
And so, on an individual basis, it's difficult to see how common these adverse effects are.
Well, it's a lot to wrap our heads around, and it kind of really turns the whole paradigm on its head. But I think it's important that people like you are undertaking a dispassionate evaluation of what has become, standard of care. And I think we've taken a major wrong turn on diet and on prescribing, and your criticisms are well warranted. For our listeners who want to take a deeper dive on this, you have a wealth of information out there on YouTube and on your website. So can you point people in the right direction? I think people will find it well worth their time to view some of these.
That, Well, I want to thank you so much for giving me a forum, an opportunity to share what I've learned with people. So I thank you for this very much.
My pleasure. So
I did mention that the professor at Duke University had criticized me openly in an op-ed at my home website at USF. So if someone goes, just Google David Diamond at University of South Florida Psychology. Even though I'm in the psychology department, I'm still a neuroscientist and a biologist. Hmm. But they will find the rebuttal that I wrote to that cardiologist, okay. And I have quite a review of the literature there. I'm also on Twitter now, and my username is LDL Skeptic.
Great.
Okay, so if you look up LDL Skeptic, you'll be able to follow where I've contributed information as well as shared information of others. And there are, you're right, it's very nice to share that there are quite a few now lectures that I have online. So again, just Googling my name with cholesterol and deception, and they'll be able to find quite a bit. I've also lectured on the diet as well, where I talked about demonization of saturated fat.
Mm.
Well, and we've got more papers coming out as well. So this isn't just about talking online. This is about publishing in medical journals. So I think that helps to validate our concerns about the current situation.
Well, congratulations on your pioneering work, your determination to get to the bottom of this controversy. And my final admonition to you is watch your back, because some great powers are arrayed against you. And I think you're taking a very courageous stance take such a hangout position.
I thank you so much. I appreciate the praise, and I appreciate that you give people this opportunity to share information out now with the public.
Okay, keep in touch with us, and we'll do a reprise when some of your new papers out, and perhaps we'll take a little different focus in future podcasts. Thanks for joining us.
Looking forward to it, Ron.
Dr. David Diamond, and the website once again is.
Well, I don't know the specific website, but if they'll Google my name at University of South Florida, Department of Psychology, they will see the rebuttal site.
Excellent. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're
I'm
very
Dr.
Welcome.
Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.